everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme is Failure of the Liberal Left. My guest today will be Chris Hedges to begin our program, and then Dr. Norman Pollack to conclude it. Chris Hedges is one of the nation's most insightful cultural critics, social and political activists, and investigative journalist. For decades, he was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America, in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. Having reported for the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, and other news outlets, while at the New York Times, Chris received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. That same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. He's authored many best-selling books. His most recent is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. It's a philosophical and historical and timely clarion call for a new revolution against a repressive political and corporate power elite. Chris's weekly column can be read every Monday at truthdig.com, and his TV program, Days of Revolt, is aired every Monday at 11 p.m. Eastern Time on Telshire TV. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris, everywhere we look now, we are witnessing what I consider the worst in what this nation has held in its collective subconscious coming to the surface. And largely, this has been a rise of regressive extremist sentiments based upon fear and hatred that is being further exploited and propagandized by mainstream media and even liberal media. And it would appear that modern liberalism and real progressive thought are running into dead ends, and the gap between Democrat and Republican has shrunk, whereby fundamental critical issues barely exist except on religious values and climate change, although both will bow to the same private interest. And yet it has been the liberal media and the left, especially the corporate left, that has largely betrayed universal, global, and humanitarian and egalitarian principles. The New York Times did so long ago, as have PBS and NPR. Even Democracy Now, often considered liberalism's media flagship, supported Obamacare against public liberal support for universal health care and also supported the U.S.'s regime change in Libya. And when it comes down to the wire, leftist media, including Pacifica, will align with mainstream elements in the Democratic Party. Yet true liberalism and progressivism yearns for alternatives and a voice after Obama betrayed the entire movement by increasing our aggressiveness overseas, surveillance and collective data on citizens' personal information, and unquestioned acceptance of Wall Street and the National Defense Authorization Act and other policies, turning the U.S. into a police state. So take your time and lay out for us what has fundamentally gone wrong in the American left and the liberal community, and what you see is the primary vortex of this. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I mean, the short answer is that the left was destroyed starting under Woodrow Wilson. And that is the theme of my book, Death of the Liberal Class, which focuses on the Wilson administration. Wilson was one of the darkest figures in American history, aside from being an unrepentant racist, resegregating the federal government. But he also was an enemy of progressive and radical movements. And he propelled the United States into World War One, although he had run in 1916 on the campaign slogan, "He kept us out of the war." He did so for a variety of reasons, one of which was that the Kaiser had begun to sink merchant shipping, including American ships, but also because with the collapse of the Eastern Front with Russia and the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, the Germans were able to move 51 divisions, which they did, over to the Western Front and nearly break the British and the French. Wall Street was apoplectic because they had largely produced the munitions and lent the money, tremendous sums, to the British and the French. And if the British and the French lost the war, they would not be repaid. And so we were propelled into a war that we did not want. There was deep anti-war sentiment. The radical movements, the socialists, the Communist Party, the anarcho-syndicalists like the Wobblies, the great socialist candidate Eugene V. Debs rose up against it. Indeed, Wilson eventually imprisoned Debs for speaking out against the war. He passed the Espionage Act, the Sedition Act. Obama has used the Espionage Act, as you correctly point out, eight times in his presidency. Now, this is not as it's designed to be used, but to shut down whistleblowers. It's the equivalent of our Foreign Secrets Act under Britain. So if you give secrets to, state secrets to a hostile power, then you're charged. He created the first system of mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, the Creel Commission, and this was massive. He imposed draconian censorship, so all print and publications had to support the war or they could not be published. This led the masses to shut themselves down till after the war, and then after the war they end up being closed. And what happened after World War One is we entered what Dwight MacDonald, a writer I admire very much, he's not read as much as he should be, calls the psychosis of permanent war. And MacDonald correctly points out that none of the political theorists, including Karl Marx, had anticipated the phenomena of the psychosis of permanent war, where you're permanently at war against an enemy who's external and internal. And that psychosis, which exists today in the supposed war on terrorism, was effectively used to break all of those progressive and radical movements that had opened up the closed spaces within American democracy. This is what makes Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States such an important book. Zinn understood that the system was designed consciously by white aristocratic male, largely slaveholders, as a closed system. Not only were African Americans, Native Americans, women disenfranchised, but so were men without property. It was the primacy of property within the system, and the system was built around that. So after the war, we begin this long assault. We see the deportation of Emma Goldman and Berkman and other radicals. We see Appeal to Reason, a socialist journal, shut down. The Masses, another socialist journal, closed. We see the persecution of groups, especially the Wobblies. Gompers in particular, who was an ally of Wilson, wanted the Wobblies destroyed, which they were. Joe Hill, on trumped-up murder charges, is killed. Big Bill Haywood, they also persecute him with a false murder charge. He has to flee the country, spends the next 10 years of his life in exile in Moscow, and dies there. And at that point, we began this long trajectory that is now culminated a century later in, as you correctly point out, a political system and political parties that do not differ in any significant way on the fundamental issues that normally define what it means to be a radical, a progressive, or a socialist. And this is the problem with a figure like Bernie Sanders. Sanders, who is a Democrat, he sits in the Democratic caucus, he's given seniority, he has campaigned since the early 90s, campaigned for Clinton in 1992, he campaigned for Clinton again in 96, he was one of the figures in 2004, calling on Ralph Nader not to run so that John Kerry could win. He is in the pocket of the Israeli lobby. He has supported almost every military appropriations bill, the security. You can't be a socialist if you're not an anti-imperialist and an anti-militarist. Socialists also call for the nationalization of large sectors of the economy, including the banking industry, which he doesn't. our radicals were persecuted, crushed, silenced. Ellen Schrecker has written a couple good books on this. No Ivory Tower, Such Were the Crimes, about the purging within academia, the arts. And we're talking about thousands of people being blacklisted, the FBI showing up at high schools with a list of 6 or 7 teachers, no evidence, of course, charging that they were communist or soft on communism. And not only are they fired from their jobs, but they can't never teach again. The arts, I.F. Stone, all the blacklisting within Hollywood. And so what happened is that all of those radical movements, which had opened up American democracy to people who had been disenfranchised by this system, are eviscerated. And then the business interests, especially after World War II, dismantle liberal institutions themselves. So they persecute people who are very far from what I would call the left, but are represent the traditional liberal class. They're purging the ACLU. This is especially with the McCarthy hearings in the 50s. They're purging universities. They're purging the media. And the result is the rise of these faux liberals, these figures like the Clintons, that speak in that feel-your-pain language of liberalism, but assiduously serve corporate power. And the only differences become, in the culture wars, what Freud would call the narcissism of minor difference, because on all of the fundamental issues, the primacy of profit and the decision to configure your society around that primacy of profit, the imperial wars, the security and surveillance state, programs, slashing programs in the name of austerity, the inability or unwillingness to confront the chronic unemployment, underemployment, the working poor, and the rise of systems of misinformation, and I know that's something that you have spoken out against, where our figures, for instance, on unemployment are just completely fictitious. We create mechanisms so that when people stop looking for work, they're dropped from the unemployment figures, or if they hold a part-time job, which puts them below the poverty line, they're counted as employed. I mean, on and on and on. I think the Los Angeles Times a couple years ago wrote an investigative piece on this issue and estimated that unemployment, real unemployment rate, was at least 17%. The same thing with the consumer price index. I mean, all of these figures have a kind of Potemkin quality to it. And so that the liberal class, which in a capitalist democracy functions as a safety valve to ameliorate the injustices and grievances, this is what Roosevelt did. And then Roosevelt says that his greatest achievement is that he saved capitalism, is broken. In the kind of folly and myopia of corporate power, they are just relentlessly driving forward in terms of impoverishing and stripping the vast majority of the citizenry of not only their rights, but any political power to respond. And these figures like Obama, and you're correct to call out many people who identify themselves in the left, but every time the elections roll around, are out there beating the drums for the Democratic Party, in the name of the least worst, or the rise of a figure like Bernie Sanders, who, unless there's some amazing development, will be on the campaign trail in the primaries, telling us all to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Do you feel any blame can be placed on the left for the rise of fascist sentiments we are witnessing with support for GOP candidates such as Trump and the continuing mainstream media support for another tyrannical wannabe, Hillary Clinton?
I think the fault is completely with the left. I mean, that's why I have long supported, as you have, Ralph Nader. Ralph knew he wouldn't win. The point was to build a group of 5, 10, 15 million Americans who said enough, who rose up and stood for progressive socialist, Ralph never uses the word socialist, but that's what he is, values. And so what we're seeing now, and Richard Rorty in his last book, Achieving Our Country, kind of presciently predicted this, is the rise of an enraged, and they have every right to be enraged, white underclass, largely not college educated, who have been pushed aside, have watched liberal politicians speak in that traditional language of liberal values while turning their backs on them. And coupled with that, because the culture wars have essentially defined, which is anti-politics, have defined political debate, an anger at marginalized communities who were supposedly promoted by this faux liberal class. Now, they weren't, actually. They redefined concepts like diversity or inclusion or even feminism. So feminism doesn't become empowering oppressed women, and in particular women of color. Feminism becomes about having a female CEO or a female president. Diversity becomes about having a black president who functions, as Cornel West says, as a black mascot for Wall Street. And so this disenfranchised white working class turns with venom on a system and on a liberal establishment that did betray them, and also on those supposed liberal values. And they begin to speak in this regressive language of racism, bigotry, intolerance, homophobia, as a way to respond. And that's what we're watching. So Trump is not the problem. If it wasn't Trump, it would be someone else. I mean, Trump has, you know, if you watch closely, he's kind of almost rather dim-witted, but he has grasped that he can ride this anger to power. And this is what demagogues do. This is what Slobodan Milosevic, who was a banker, did in the former Yugoslavia. And there's actually footage of him speaking in Kosovo to ethnic Serbs. So the ethnic Serbs were a tiny minority in Kosovo. Most of 90% of Kosovo are Kosovar Albanians. And they were colonizers in essence. They had Kosovo was a province within Yugoslavia. And he begins to chant, they will not beat you. And the crowd comes to life. So with the economic breakdown of Yugoslavia, you have the rise of these Trump-like demagogues, Franjo Tuđman in Croatia, or Radovan Karadžić in Bosnia, who are kind of buffoonish. I mean, they weren't. They were completely buffoonish in the way that the Nazis before they took power were buffoonish. But they're dangerous buffoons, and that's what we're watching. And it goes back, the roots of this go back to the collapse of a liberal establishment that was once able to respond in a limited way to the plight of the underclass, but which was eviscerated. I mean, you know, the person who writes about this as presciently as anyone is Dostoevsky in Notes from Underground. And that's what we're seeing. So Trump is not the issue. The issue is the breakdown of civil society and the collapse of a legitimate left that once represented the interests of the poor and working men and women, but has abandoned them. And you are correct to say that this has extended beyond the Democratic Party into self-identified left organizations, but who have decided that they want to be players within the Democratic establishment, rather than defend the values that they should be defending.
This past weekend, I did a lecture as a fundraiser for the sister station WBAI, and probably 90% of the audience were African-American. And afterwards, there was a long line of people to ask personal questions, mainly about health. But one woman in particular stuck out to me. She came up and she said, could you do a program in one of your commentaries or have someone on that will address how the African-American political class, including Obama and Jesse Jackson, many others, and specifically the Democratic Black Caucus, has sold out African-Americans and other minorities. It's never discussed, and especially on this station and others. And I said, sure. And I was thinking, could you address that, of how people who are already struggling, who have had a history of oppression, are put their hope into the hands of people who give them promises that things will change. Then you end up with Eric Holter. You end up with Obama. You end up with people who are African-American and who are powerful people, respected people in many ways. But what exactly have they done to change the underlying system, the paradigm, to prevent or reverse all of these discriminatory policies?
Well, they have sold out their own. Cornel West has addressed this. You know, the kind of betrayal of the black elite. That's not just a race issue. I mean, most elites betray the underclass, and black elites have been no different. I mean, the fact is, for the bottom two-thirds of African-Americans in this country, things are worse than when King marched in Selma. And Cornell has also highlighted the assault against the black prophetic tradition, which I would argue is maybe the most important intellectual tradition in America, because African-Americans, because of their experience under white supremacy, understand in a visceral way the reality of empire and colonialism in a way that most whites do not. And until Obama, they have instinctively stood up against the crimes of empire. And that black prophetic tradition has been marginalized and replaced with this magical thinking, which is endemic throughout the culture. And it goes like this: if you can, you know, focus on happiness, or you can dig deep enough within yourself, or you can grasp you are truly exceptional, or if you believe in magic Jesus, everything will be fine. And that structures of oppression don't matter. It's all about you. I mean, this is what makes Bill Cosby such a repugnant figure on many levels, including apparently being a sexual predator. But Obama delivers the same message. So does Oprah. That message is across the political and cultural landscape, and it is a non-reality-based belief system, as if structural and institutional racism don't exist. I live in Princeton, New Jersey. We have one of the best public high schools in the country. You drive 50 minutes to Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, and you have schools that do not function as schools. So you can be a person of color in Camden and may not hear a racial insult, but structural racism is firmly in place to make sure that it's almost impossible, if you're poor, to escape. And we don't address structures. We engage in this kind of infantile talk about education. I mean, I find Obama's constant call for education absurd. The people who got us into this financial mess were the best educated people in the country, including Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard. The problem was greed. And the black elites, like the white elites, because if they play the game, they can become very wealthy. Look at the Clintons. I think Bill and Hillary Clinton made $35 million last year giving supposed lectures to places like Goldman Sachs for $100,000 or more. That's just legalized bribery. And that's what the system is about. And if you, I mean, you watch Obama. He's kind of counting the days until he walks out the door to become exceedingly wealthy and raise $500 million for two presidential libraries. I mean, this is the game they all play. And the underclass, including the black underclass, is paying for it.
How about the failures of the green environmental movement? I know this is something Derek Jensen, who you know well, has commented upon and expressed a more radical stance than the foundations upon which modern Western civilization is based. Free market capitalism and the myth of infinite progress and growth and resources is the root cause of our environmental threats, and therefore we find these large environmental groups such as the Worldwide Wildlife Fund, the Sierra Club, the National Resources Defense Council, etc., operating within the corporate regulatory system and thereby perpetuating the threats to a sustainable future as much as the policies and missions of our corporate government system. And I do feel there are positive changes in environmental activism now, since more people gradually get it. Your thoughts on the climate change stance in the on the left and how it is covered by the liberal media?
Well, you're right. I mean, Big Green, like all these nonprofit institutions, which become lucrative businesses, collaborate with corporate power. I mean, the utter silence about the animal agriculture industry, which is arguably the most important contributor to carbon emissions, complete silence, especially by the environmental groups. Although statistically they know it, they won't take on that industry. They work in all sorts of accommodationist fashion, I mean, even with frackers. And they legitimize a system that is dysfunctional, as if lobbying corporate pawns in Congress or state legislatures is going to be a solution to the environmental crisis that we face. I mean, we have seen all sorts of regulations and environmental reforms passed in the last three decades, and carbon emissions have risen by perhaps as much as 60%. It's a failure, and it's a failure because these groups will not confront the engine of the gayicide that we are enduring, which is unfettered, unregulated capitalism, which does what it's designed to do, which is commodify everything. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse. And that's why the environmental crisis is twinned with the economic crisis.
There may be,
and these groups have failed.
I want to share a different direction here for a moment. The left has been divided between those who feel the system can be reformed internally, simply by electing more enlightened leaders within a duopoly in power, and then those who believe, like myself, that the entire system is incorrigible and beyond reform, and only self-implosion might restore some sense of meaning and sanity to our structure of government. For example, although I admire Bill McKibben, he's done a lot of good on many environmental and climate change issues, I would share a difference of opinion with him on the political system. He believes it can be reformed by electing a party candidate who remains indebted, not indebted to the status quo. And today, anyone who is part of the environmental, animal rights, and civil society movements is under surveillance, can potentially be marked as an enemy of the state. So there are, in my opinion, there are no viable ways of moving forward to change a movement from inside. It is too corrupt at too many levels. And all these movements, like the Paris two-week fiasco, These are dances of deception. They'll make promises that are not binding. India just today stated that they're going to double the amount of coal production in the next 5 years. Well, exactly how does that then reconcile with their idea that they need to reduce some climate change emitters? No one is engaged in this. They will say they are, but they're not. And there are those on the left who absolutely stay determined, instead of recommending what I would recommend, general strikes, massive boycotts of all companies engaged in pollution. Instead, they say, well, no, we're not going to change anything in our personal life, but we are going to look for those candidates and support them who are more liberal and will likely do something. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we live in a system, the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin called inverted totalitarianism, which is about the primacy of corporate power at the expense of democratic institutions and, you know, our right to participate in the political and economic process. And, you know, the thing about inverted totalitarianism is that it masks itself as democracy in the same way that the dictatorships of the late Roman Republic masked themselves as part of a republic. So you have corporate power that purports to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, civil liberties, but internally has seized the levers of power to render the citizen impotent.
Hmm.
And the only way we're going to fight back now, and we don't have much time left, is to break the system. And that means, you know, almost militarized nonviolent resistance, waves of 50 or 100 people who block day after day train tracks, routes in and out of refineries. But sitting around waiting for figures in Paris or Washington or anywhere else to address the issue is the triumph of hope over experience. You wonder if these people have been awake over the last three decades and longer. And I think that there are, especially among radical young activists, an understanding that this is all there is. With Black Lives Matter, with at least at the grassroots, with many of the anti-fracking activists who I spoke to in Denver a few weeks ago from around the country, with the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against Israel, which I support, which college by college, institution by institution, is attempting to do to the apartheid state of Israel what was done to the apartheid state of South Africa. And that's our only hope. That's the theme of the book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. I'm not interested in sugarcoating what we're up against. This is the most efficient and ruthless security and surveillance apparatus ever imposed on humankind. And as a reporter, I covered the Stasi state in East Germany. Even if we stop all carbon emissions today, we are still going to suffer catastrophic climate change. And yet, I argue in the book that resistance is finally carried out not for what we can achieve, but for who it allows us to become, which is free, independent, moral human beings who stand up against, and I don't use this phrase lightly, forces of death, to affirm and protect forces of life. And I speak especially as a father. You know, I may fail, but at least I want my children to look back and say he tried.
Mm. Good for you. My final thought on this is, and we've discussed this before, that is the loss of universal spiritual values. It's not being recognized and acted upon throughout the United States, and the secularization of the liberal left and trying to be the antidote to the Judeo-Christian extremism on the right, which has taken over the Republican Party, has resulted in the left losing its moral and spiritual bearings. And if liberal political and social leaders haven't experienced the life of spiritual principles within themselves, how can we then expect them to apply those principles without being hypocrites. And all the great spiritual religious reformers, whether it's Gandhi or Dorothy Day or Martin Luther King, actually embodied and lived those higher spiritual principles, not simply regurgitating them to the public. So the question that I think we have to ask ourselves today is the liberal left capable of this? So, Chris, all the best with Wages of Rebellion, and thank you for being with us today, and we look forward to our next discussion.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris Hedges, back in a moment with Norman Pollack. Please stay with us. Now, we have phone right now,
thank
so
you,
let's
Gary.
Go over and say hello to Professor Norman Pollack. He is a professor emeritus of history at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. He has a long history of engaging civil rights and anti-war activities over the decades, beginning when he was 15 and campaigning for Henry Wallace and his Progressive Party in 1948. He later campaigned for Adlai Stevenson in the 50s and supported Martin Luther King. He's a two-time Guggenheim Fellow. Professor Pollack was a major intellectual voice during the late 1960s in giving a knowledgeable boost to the New Left in writing on American populism, which became a popular documentary, The Populist Mind. He received his doctorate in American Civilization from Harvard University. He was professor at Yale University, Wayne State University, before going to Michigan. And he is with us today. Nice to have you with us again.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you, Gary. And I was really fascinated by your the portion with Chris, because what he said was so articulate and well thought out, and I'm not sure that a guy like me can add that much to it. So I'm looking forward to the kinds of questions you might have.
Well, let's begin, and I'm sure that you will not only compliment what he said, but provide us with your unique monikered signature of an intellectual in-depth conversation. One of the issues I would like for you to discuss is whether or not the liberal left is clinically dead in the United States today. I don't say that with any sense of sarcasm. It's not even an existential projection. Health basically means that the energies that support health are functional and more active and vital than the elements that are associated with disease and illness. It's a balancing act. And today it is clear that the characteristics that are usually associated with right extremism and fascism and bigotry and hatred are becomingly increasingly dominant. And Obama ran as a progressive, though he has not once done anything remotely progressive. He has done everything corporately, and he has had a big alignment, including the leaders of unions, which are unfortunate because I feel they betrayed their members. And he does not engage in any fair conditions. And look at where the average worker is today compared to then. And Hillary Clinton was Obama's Secretary of State, and even more aligned with the pathology of the conservative right. And what's disturbing to me is that over and over again, the Democratic caucuses, almost all, with few exceptions, make up excuses and apologies for Obama's horrendous reign of terror in the White House. His trade partnerships, the Trans-Pacific Partnership being the most toxic capitalist and authoritarian trade agreement in history, and his expansion of militarism, his siding and abetting with Wall Street, his causing the arming of the Islamics, the protecting Turkey, so that all for a year. And by the way, you know, the American media didn't touch this once. All those trucks ISIS had, several thousand, loading up on stolen Syrian oil and also Iraq oil, bring it right through into Turkey. Turkey then getting it into other countries, including Israel, giving ISIS about $4 million a day. And yet here's the president and his joint chief and all the military establishment saying, we want to do something about it. Well, you're allowing them to make $4 million a day. You're not challenging Saudi Arabia. You're not challenging Turkey, a totally terrorist state with complete kleptocracy as its overriding rule. And now Putin comes in and he destroys 1,200 trucks. And suddenly we're concerned not about stopping terrorism, but about stopping Putin from stopping terrorism. And the left sides again and again with Obama and never is on the side of truth. I don't even read the New York Times anymore because it's a record of deception, not a record I would trust. But that's the entire left. I mean the entire left. You cannot trust them. They are morally bankrupt. That is my personal opinion, and I said this with Chris. He also feels the same way. So here's Obama gathering the top 12 Wall Street CEOs and bring him to the White House, and he stood in front of him. He says that he is the only thing between them and pitchforks, and that he wanted to help them and protect them from congressional and public anger. And we have seen how Obama and the entire corporate liberal establishment has succeeded in supporting and protecting the wealthy and not the average person. So all due to his sitting in the White House. So if the liberal political faction in Washington must apologize for Obama's record of betrayal and failure to the American public, then in effect the liberal cause in Washington, in my opinion, is essentially dead. However, I can be wrong on this. Share your thoughts, please.
Okay, right, Gary. My first thought, and I'm quite different on this from most people, is that I make a very stronger, firmer, clear distinction between liberal and radical. And I simply do not expect from liberals more than a cosmetic change, an accommodation to the existing structure of power, a kind of liberalization of war, which means to enlist the acquiescence of the underlying population. And once you start that, it's very easy to impose all kinds of measures of thought control, surveillance, and so on. So the problem, let me see if I can even, you said so many good things. The problem with liberalism is that historically, and I would like to say by definition, it has never broken with capitalism. And that is to say it's worked, moved stride for stride with capitalism as it has developed and advanced. Now, one of the things that comes out here, among many, is you get a kind of bifurcation between domestic and foreign policy. Both of you had mentioned, I believe, Sanders and what Bernie Sanders represents. And it was pointed out very correctly that on foreign policy, he goes right down the line, measure for measure, intervention for intervention, war for war, with the Democrats, and to some extent even the predecessor, both Bush and then Bill Clinton, and so there's something very fashionable that they're getting away with here that has been going on for a long time, in which the Democratic Party, and especially identified as liberal, has always been a war party, has always been really almost more of an activating force for intervention than, at least in decades ago, than traditional Republicans might have been. And so... Right off the bat, Gary, I can say, A, I'm not surprised, not only what you said, but where we are at this point. But then my feeling is that, in fact, domestic and foreign policy make an integrated whole. And if one has a position in foreign policy, which is interventionist, covert action, regime change, you name it, the things that we actually do, that person just cannot have what let's call a progressive domestic policy. They really do go together. So that boundaries are set up, whether they're consciously set up, intuitively set up, or I would like to even say structurally set up, because where I think I might differ from a lot of people is in trying to be a little more structural in the analysis. Now, by that I mean, if we go back to Chris for a second, and he was right on in his indictment, and it is an indictment and a valid one, of the Wilson administration. And you could see that with everything. I would have emphasized more the Siberian intervention, which really was the basis for the whole Cold War subsequently. But in fact, Wilson is, in a way, let me say it sort of folksy-like, Wilson was par for the course. You go back just one step to Theodore Roosevelt, and Theodore Roosevelt is a real imperialist who builds a battleship navy, who really forces the whole development of market penetration in all kinds of areas. And then if you keep going back, what you see is that liberalism itself has always been very intimately attached to the property right. That is the classic 17th century English definition for liberalism, and it hasn't really changed. And I think that unless, and I'm not here saying, well, I guess I am saying that one has to look at perhaps two distinct areas of social control. And one distinct area is the actual repression. I think that you and Chris brought that out very well, and you can see that, whether it's McCarthyism, whether it's the Patriot Act today, whether it's massive surveillance and so on, there is definitely, from that source alone or that angle alone, a narrowing of boundaries of permissible dissent. It's shrinking daily. It's shrinking to the point where someone from 1960 or 65 would step into this context and would scream. It would be so obvious, but it's part of that. And this is what one has to assess, and it's part of what you guys were talking about and what you're now asking about or discussing, is the way traditional left groups, labor unions, and so on, have so completely internalized the value system. And you'd have to then ask yourself, how does that happen? Why does that happen? And that's where I sort of want to go back to structural things, because it isn't just the specifics of political repression, it's the nature of the society itself. And that nature really goes back almost to the founding of the country. And by that I mean, and I know it may seem remote to even bring this kind of thing out, but in a way, unlike practically any other country that I'm aware of, we really had a kind of puristic expression of capitalism. Very little intervening that would provide for alternatives or modifications or control and regulation. So that capitalism develops. You see it in the late 19th century, and it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable in the way industry and railroads, et cetera, developed, and banking, and how by the turn of that century of the 20th century, banking, for example, really does come into its own in control of government to the extent that it can write the legislation intended, presumably, to regulate it. So here again, we've got Wilson with the Federal Reserve System. And the Federal Reserve System is not a democratization of banking. It is a kind of self-regulation where bankers determine their own policies and then get legitimacy from the stamp of approval of government. And that's the nature of all regulation in American history. There hasn't been a kind of adversarial relationship ever established. Where I might want to disagree with Chris a little bit, and that is important, but just to look at the century itself, I guess I'm an old sentimentalist and so on, but I still do see some contrary negative, meaning in this case very good things, things coming out of the New Deal. Now, sure, Roosevelt himself, as was pointed out, said that he saved capitalism. That's true. But within that whole ferment, there was a lot going on with the rise of the CIO, with all kinds of dissident groups, with the Communist Party, which, without really knowing enough about it, but my experience or my sense of it is, has never really been a militant force, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but basically I think of it as a party of dentists who are looking for I won't even say that. Okay, but the point being that there really was an authentic left. It certainly permeated our literature. It really fastened on the kinds of grave, horrible experiences of impoverishment and dignified that and brought it out so that there was, for a brief moment, a breaking through of that consensus on capitalism that had so firmly held its ground. And then here's the question, or one question, and Chris is bringing this out. I've never thought of it before. He said it. The idea of perpetual war. The point here is that war itself does have to be analyzed as a factor in the conservatizing. You might even say, I can't even think of the word, but almost like the incipient fascization of a whole culture and society. War does that. And sure, we have been on a permanent war footing, certainly since 1945, following the war. And it seems to me that what Obama is doing now, when there was, and it wasn't really a respite, it was just kind of below the radar a little, but what Obama is doing is truly risking, through an awakened second major Cold War, he's really risking the kind of confrontation both with Russia and China that could blow up in everybody's face. It is very dangerous.
Norman, I appreciate those overviews. We have time for just one more answer.
Sure.
For you, so if you could make it just a little shorter.
I recall
that you've written about the psychopathology of American liberalism and its role in ushering in the building blocks that can potentially evolve into fascism. In large part, this is because both the Democrat left and the Republican right adhere to caste systems that support a ruling class and is all too willing to have a law for the ruling oligarchy and a separate set of laws that applies to everyone else. You never hear of a ruling class member having to be stopped and searched. They are never profiled where their cars are stopped. And yet that happens all the time to the other. I remember once I was invited to a fundraiser for Bill Clinton, and a couple who are is a liberal power couple, one of the most respected and powerful in the United States. It was at their home. They have a private brownstone. And I said, who's going to be there? And I remember the conversation was, everyone who's important is a Democrat. Why are they coming? Mm-hmm. I asked, well, because you're kidding? And I said, no, I'm not kidding. Why are they coming? I know something about Bill Clinton. Do you? Do you know what goes on at Mena, Arkansas? No, but I know this. Everyone who's going to be there is going to be able to make deals through his administration. So it's going to allow everyone who's at the beginning to have like an insider's deal. And I thought, well, that's not why you should be supporting a person for president, because you're a deal maker. And yet the entire left has had this preoccupation with their own sense of entitlement. And yet it is never discussed as if, well, we're left, we're liberal, we're populist. No, you're not. And this has been a hypocrisy that is palpable. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, Gary, all I can say is right off the bat that when you're speaking of the left as almost non-existent now, what we have seen, and we would not want to stop there, we'd want to try for an explanation, but what we've clearly seen is exactly what you described, which is to say that the left has been complicit in the existing structure of power. And for me, this has to go back to very deep-seated kinds of things. I'll give you the most trivial example, but just to say how alert we are to distinctions of wealth. When I was a kid, Buick had the Roadmaster and the Super. 1946-47 with portholes. Three portholes, super. Four portholes, Roadmaster. Every kid knew the difference between the two and automatically assumed that the one with the four portholes was the better person. What we've got is this kind of veneration for the worst kinds of things. We've destroyed any conception of the human as human, and it's the human in some other capacity, whether as a power holder, as a person of wealth, or a celebrity, or what have you. And that I still chalk up to what seems to me to be at the basis for so much, and that is this whole place and veneration of property itself as the determinant of culture, the determinant of ideology, and so on. So this is not to say, for the youngsters who are thinking about this, this is not to say sit on your hands and see that this is too powerful to oppose. It isn't. And I share your view about a more direct kind of thing.
Norman, unfortunately, we're out of time.
But okay.
I think what I would take away from this is that we, the people who do not align with an elite concept of life, who value life at the spiritual level, at the humanistic level, at the earth level, at the animal love level, that we are not in love with power, greed, position, possessions. And therefore, that is not why we work. That is not why we strive. And as long as we continue to support those who do, elect those who do, and when we venerate, as you said, the person, I would say we venerate institutions. We venerate those who graduate from Harvard and Yale and Princeton, your former universities, as being better than, smarter than, more entitled than someone who graduated with a similar degree but from a state university. We've got to get away from our own inbred, hardwired sense of elitism and start looking at life more realistically. Thank you very much, Norman Pollack, for being with us today. Always a pleasure having you on.
Thanks very much, Gary. Bye-bye.
I'm Gary Knoll. That brings us up to the end of another Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live near Baba's lives. Mercy, all things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand it?